Hello. Thank you, Melanie. Nice to see you. Melanie is actually staying with us here at the Moulin at the moment, so she's only a few hundred meters away. So we saw each other today. Meanwhile, hello, everyone. So nice just to see your names scrolling down the screen to read your appreciations of being back in this great global world-spanning Dharma hall together. And very nice as well to see a whole bunch of you who say that you're here for the first time. So if that's the case, hey, please feel especially welcome. And maybe you get the sense, you know, and seeing if you're new here, it's just seeing the names and the greetings, you maybe get the sense there's kind of a beautiful sense of sangha here that's been built up over the last years as we started off with these Sunday sessions and then added more on the live daily practice that we do every day, Monday to Friday as well. And I'll mention some of that stuff at the end. But basically, there's the sense that I often mention on the daily meditations of this being a kind of vast, vast Dharma hall with a huge sheltering roof and with no walls. And so that sense of really being, open to you, open that we can come here, explore here, practice here, share our love of Dharma practice and transformational meditative practices together. And, also share that which might be difficult and have some sense of it being held in a common heart, held amongst others who know what it's like, to hit the painful spots in one's life, one's personal life, the collective life. And so it's not just when I say, you're welcome, it's not just you who are welcome to come and practice here and be here. It's really all of you. It's that sense of whatever's here. And maybe as we start, that's a good kind of invitation just to bring all of yourself. So if there's something that's been difficult today, and I know for some of you, it's still relatively early in the morning. Some of you, it's the midday. Some of you, it's the, like me, it's the evening. Some of you, it's the late night, right? Depending. Some of you, it's the next tomorrow morning already in New Zealand. So wherever you are and however you are, as we begin, just that invitation, whatever the atmosphere of your heart is right now, and whatever the activity of your mind is, and whatever the condition of your body is, and however the world around you is, just to have that sense as we begin of that it's all welcome. There's no wrong experience. There's no feeling that you shouldn't have or that can't be kind of met and made room for here. So it's in that spirit, really, that I'm really happy to be here with you, to welcome you all, and to have this time together. Yeah. And so in some ways, it feels like something of a celebration. Right? Oh, coming back, the beginning, starting these and the daily sessions again, after the summer break of a month. And on the other hand, and I like contrasts and paradox, but so on the one hand, it feels like a celebration. On the other hand, it's kind of heavy material, right? The title of the class this evening is Leaning into Collapse. And to explore, we might subtitle that, how to love a dying world. And I guess if you've made it to here, you're interested in that. I mean, my goodness, we should be interested in that as humans. And I guess you also probably read the little the reflection of a few paragraphs that I wrote midweek in preparation for this. And around the time I wrote that, it was also around the time when Hurricane Ida was hitting New Orleans. One of our staff, one of the team here at Sangha Live, who lives in New Orleans and evacuated, left the city right before the storm hit. Others of you, you know, I know there's a lot of you in New York. Some of you, I saw your names and I know you well, and what I've lived very directly the impact of the storm and the way in which it's not just the impact of a storm. It's sort of resonant, and more through the fires over much of the Western US, much of Southern Europe, all through this summer, vast swathes of the North as well across Siberia. It's not just the fires, you know, it's like through the increasing frequency and increasing severity of extreme weather, fires, floods, and freezes. Beyond the impact of just the particular storm, the particular event, increasingly, as we witness more of these, each event is kind of redolent of the wider impact of an increasingly unstable climate, of increasingly precarious conditions for human flourishing. We're living through increasingly precarious conditions for human flourishing and for that of many, many other species. In fact, many, many other species have gone beyond flourishing and into extinction. And so there's this, as well as the political instability, right? The recent terrible upheaval and tragedy and oppression and death and desperation in Afghanistan, and the ongoing dramas and tragedy of the pandemic, and the polarization around issues of vaccination and masks, etc., etc. And of course, social and political instability and polarization are actually also symptoms of collapse. So I don't want to spend this hour and a half that we have together enumerating the stuff that you know about ecological collapse and political and social collapse. What I want to do, certainly just to evoke the reality of that, and I want to make room for how have you, over the last few months even, maybe the last few years, how have you been living the impact of these kinds of instabilities? And maybe for some of you, it might feel like they also mirror instabilities or uncertainties in your own personal lives as well. And then also to explore, okay, how can the heart digest and metabolize, the impacts of these things in a way that's wise and both allows us to stay steady and awake and open-hearted in the midst of these collapsing or destabilizing conditions. What might we find as a response? It feels a real response, an authentic response, a meaningful response, a helpful response. And how might we understand the nature of collapsing conditions in as deep a way as possible? Because it's kind of, it's Dharma 101. If you've done any amount of meditation practice within the Buddhist tradition, you'll have been exposed very quickly and immediately to the thread that runs so centrally through all Dharma practice and all Dharma teachings, the thread of attuning to the fact that everything's unstable, everything's changing, everything's running away from us. Our own life is running out, running out, running out, breath by breath. All conditions, because they've arisen, they have to fall apart. And on the one hand, that's just so fundamental. Yeah, we get that, of course. And on the other hand, certainly for me, over 30 years of these practices, it's been a kind of, and again and again and again and again kind of process of, of taking that truth into the heart, of living in the light of that truth, of touching, endlessly different nuances of that truth of the changing nature of things. I want to give us a chance as well to look at how that metabolizing of collapse gets mirrored, how we deal with uncomfortable truths, how we deal with unstable situations, how we deal with uncertainty, how that is mirrored between the way we meet our own collapsing life, our own impending death, and how we meet the wider possibility, we could say. I mean, actually the wider certainty, right? The certainty that human civilization will collapse, has to. I mean, at some point, everything collapses. That the Earth itself, this whole planet, this whole marvelous, exquisite, beautiful, stupendous marvel that is this planet, will itself collapse. So there's the certainty of that, right? But along what time frame, we don't know. And then there's the possibility. And that's always been the case, right? For every generation, it's been the case that within our lifetimes, some major collapse. And of course, major collapses have happened periodically. Civilizations have collapsed, disappeared. There's a thriving civilization in Egypt, in ancient Greece, in the thriving civilizations of the Axial Age. It's the sense that these systems and cultures and ways of life that must have seemed so stable for a while, right? Things seem stable until suddenly they're not. Things aren't stable, but they seem stable. You can look around you, right? If you're sitting here in your home probably feels stable. Right? How long have you been there? It's like we sort of take it for granted that the roof will stay on and the walls will stay up. It seems stable until one day, lightning strikes or a tree falls in the house or whatever. So to draw some of those parallels together. And I also want to make time. Hello, darling. This is Priya. Some of you already know her. She's come to say hello. I also want to make time just to explore a lot together so that it's not just, me talking at you, and that we get a chance to hear from you, hear each other, explore, so that some of maybe of that, the digesting maybe of some of the fear or some of the outrage, or some of the struggle with that sense of uncertainty can also get met. And before we get into any of that, then some meditation practice. And with the meditation, I thought what might be helpful is for us to just, we'll spend, 25 minutes together just sitting. I'll give a little bit of guidance, especially at the beginning, a couple of reminders as we go through. But the emphasis I want to be on just letting our field of awareness, right? The simple fact of being here, being alive, being conscious, the very fact of being this sensitive organism, right? Being in this sensitive organism where we find ourselves, we're in this hearing, in this sense of a body and a world. And consciousness. To let the field of our being here be as wide and as open and as inclusive as possible. So that while we sit, we might get maybe the real sense, or maybe just a little taste of the way in which the nature of our being, the nature of consciousness, is vast and open and inclusive. There's a way in which we can really know and taste and feel our complete belonging to everything. And as we might explore after the meditation, it seems to me that that sense of belonging, which we can taste and increasingly become familiar with and rest into and know ourselves as, this deep sense of belonging to the world, belonging to life, belonging to everything, is fundamental to us making, both individually and collectively, making a wise response, a loving response to the world we live in and to its changing nature. So, please take your seat in whatever way seems comfortable to you. It allows you to sit here in a way that's bright, awake, attentive, and also in a way that's natural, simple, easeful. And in this way, then, we meditate together. As you settle, right, settle first just into the very natural, simple feel of sitting here. Really feeling the way you, that there's those dense sensations in your buttocks and your legs on the chair or the cushion. I'm sensing the feel of the air and the space and the sounds around you. And sensing the aliveness of your attention. Don't try to make your attention go anywhere yet. Don't try to squeeze your attention down into your breath or into any point where you might normally try to focus. Just really being aware that you have this power of attention. Your mind can be directed. And inviting your attention just to settle into the feel of being here. In whatever way. Settle into body sitting. Breath, breathing. Settling into both the feel of inner, the world of sensations and breathing, and the sense of outer sensations of the skin, sounds, and letting your attention just be wide enough, open enough to take in both equally. What we call inner and what we call outer. Just letting it all be met, letting it all be known, letting it all come and go in this field of attention. Whatever happens, whatever thoughts, whatever sensations, whatever sounds, just letting them have their coming and going in the field of your attention. In this field of attention that we call awareness. Well, the very nature of awareness is that it's spacious. It's open. It makes room for whatever enters into this field, whatever thought arises, there's room for it. Whatever sound comes and goes, it's accommodated. All the comings and goings of experience. All the comings and goings of the universe can be welcomed in awareness. Right here is where we meet life, just as it is. practicing in such a way as to let nothing get stuck. Just comings and goings. And if your attention starts to stabilize, see if you can just let the field of your attention be wider. Maybe even infinitely wide. Wide open. So that the basic luminosity of awareness is like sunlight. And everything that appears is naturally bathed in that sunlight. Any time you find yourself caught up in some mental activity, some thought stream, some fantasy or memory, just notice that the very fact that you can suddenly recognize that you've been caught up is because of the sunlight of awareness. You can notice that you've been lost in thought just because awareness is here, receiving that thought, making room for that thought, allowing it then to have its coming and going. So I'm just sitting like this for the remaining 10 minutes or so, letting everything that arises be bathed in the sunlight of awareness. Natural, open, spacious, loving. in the open space of awareness, in the loving sunlight of a wide open consciousness. Everything's welcome, nothing left out. Everything belongs. All sensations, all thoughts, all sounds, all beings. For these last few moments, just seeing if you can really let everything belong. Nothing to resist or reject or retain. The comings and goings. The dust specks of experience dancing in the sunlight of awareness. May we learn to let everything belong. May we see how our own living, dying nature belongs to the living, dying nature of everything. May we be unafraid of our dying, so as to best support our living, so as to flourish here and now, for we know not long how long we have. May we learn to love the arisings and the passings. When we began that meditation, the last of the day's sunlight was, I could see the slanting shadows and the orange end of daylight outside my window. And over the course of meditation, the dusk has come and the day has darkened, settled, quietened. Sometimes sitting like that, whether sitting alone or sitting in the mutual belonging of all of us, but sitting with that emphasis on the fundamental embrace of life, the complete inclusivity or inclusion of life. It's kind of profoundly soothing for the soul. Deeply soothing to know that belonging, to know that in the deepest sense possible, nothing can go wrong. Nothing can go wrong. It's a challenging idea that nothing can go wrong. We look at ourselves and our various challenges and problems. We look around us at the world and its challenges and problems. And we look at the emotional response we might have to our personal situation or to the, social situation or the global situation. It might even sound reckless, deluded, irresponsible, the idea that nothing can go wrong, when we can point to so much that clearly is going wrong. But the deeper we go, and the more we rest in that belonging, and the more we understand the natural, inevitable comings and goings of things, the more it might just become a bedrock of truth and peace for us. That nothing can go wrong. So I'd like us to, if possible, to bear that in mind, that nothing can go wrong, as we look together a little at all the things that are going wrong. So I'll speak for some minutes, and then we'll also have the opportunity to explore and to hear from you. First of all, let's just the word. Just notice for yourself when I say collapse, what are the associations you might have? Collapse. If you think of yourself collapsing, or if you think of some of the situations we touched on before the meditation, if we think of our ecological system collapsing, the delicate, the climactic balance of the way the jet stream and the various weather patterns and the humidity and the way rainfall and heat has existed, not exactly in balance, but in enough kind of amazing fluid movement for thousands and thousands, many, many, many thousands of years in a way that's been able to support human flourishing. And we look to the very real evidence that that is collapsing. It's important. If we don't understand the emotional impact of something as, as much of a bigger deal as this, collapse, then we tend to go one way or the other in the arguments for or against. We tend to go too quickly into, what do we need to do about it? Right? Or, oh my God, it's hopeless. There's nothing we can do about it. And so we either kind of, escape from the discomfort into a lot of action, or we escape from the discomfort into some kind of withdrawal. And ironically, a kind of collapse. We can collapse into despair or collapse into hopelessness, maybe. So in here and now, this isn't the forum for what you might do. There's plenty of other places, good places for that. And there's interesting, important work places to go, like the deep adaptation work. Maybe some of you are familiar with deep adaptation and some of the conversations and initiatives around that. Right now, there's the Extinction Rebellion action happening, particularly in the UK right now, over 2 weeks. And using nonviolent direct action and disruption techniques, which can be annoying. Casper Hughes wrote a good article. He's very involved in Extinction Rebellion and in Dharma practice, and wrote a great article in the Financial Times the other day about how Extinction Rebellion is annoying and how he understands that it's annoying, but how it actually needs to be annoying. We need to get annoyed out of our familiar rhythms. So there's deep adaptation and Extinction Rebellion. There's the writings and the wisdom and the kind of beautiful, deep explorations of our own kind of Buddhist grandmother in the ecological sphere, Joanna Macy, and her, particularly her recent explorations, where rather than the idea of going from the kind of consumptive and destructive culture, which, and of course it's generative and creative in various ways, but ecologically, human culture, you know, increasingly in intensity over, particularly since the Industrial Revolution, of course, human culture has been ecologically consumptive and destructive. We've consumed and destroyed the natural world, air, oceans, forests, etc., etc. And rather than the idea of that being turning, being able to go beyond that to some kind of regenerative culture, right? The body of scientific opinion increasingly weighs towards the idea that that's at least maybe not possible. Some, you know, authorities would say it's very probably not possible. Some would say it is not possible, you know, that enough tipping points have been reached that we can't go from destructive to regenerative. Now it's too late. We've set in motion, you know, you may have already reached peak human, as I said in my midweek reflections. And it strikes me, you know, 2019 was maybe, of course, not for everybody and not in all places in the world, but maybe for you and me, or many of us here, was the kind of peak of our ease of travel, our ease of movement, our ease of social interaction, our ease of procuring the stuff we like, etc. And maybe that degree of ease it won't ever come back. And so Joanna is talking increasingly these days about the regenerative culture not being something to get to when we get past the destructive consumptive culture to some kind of regenerative culture, but we need to find the regenerative culture here and now. How can we, you and me, how can we be regenerative? How can we live and think and act and feel and respond to life in ways that are generative, that are creative, that are loving, so that we express, you know, our love for the world, so that we respond to the beauty of the world, the preciousness of the world. You know, if we're in some kind of times of collapse, how tragic it would be that the collapsing nature, the destructive nature, the consumptive nature, and our grief for it, and our anger maybe about it, and our fear of it, if that overtakes us, then those are the forces that drive us all into collapse. I ended the midweek reflections with that line from Merwin's poem that he opens with, "On the last day of the world, I'd like to plant a tree." And the reason I love that so much is because it expresses that spirit, right, of love, creativity, you know, acting in alignment with one's love for the world, with one's deepest values, regardless of what's going to happen. So we don't have to wait for the last day of the world to plant trees, right? No, you can be regenerative now and now and now. But that vision, right, of acting in alignment with love and belonging, right? Compassion and interconnection, regardless of what's happening around us and throughout whatever phases of collapse you and I may be the generation that lives through. And we could equally, I was just reflecting this evening before starting the class, I was walking down by the river and thinking, one could also equally say, on the last day of the tree, on the last day of the world, I'd like to be meditating deeply on the beauty of everything, the beauty of the last sunset. And one could equally say, on the last day of the world, I'd like to dance. And just like I asked you a moment ago to reflect on the impact of collapse, I think that's a good contemplative exercise. On the last day of the world, what? On the last day of the world, I'd like to what? And it's not that there's a right answer, and certainly don't judge yourself for your answers. You may find, right? I would say, the more we're in denial of our own death, the more likely we are to kind of grasp at desperate pleasures on the last day of the world, you know. But when I talk about on the last day of the world dancing or planting a tree, it's not about the gratification of that. It's about some way of expressing beauty. I mean, how amazing to be human. How amazing to be here on a planet with air and water and earth and sky and forest. How amazing if it were to be that you and I were the generation, because one or other generation inevitably will be the generation. How amazing if you or I were to get to be here on the last day of the world. And I don't want to overly emphasize that, what can seem apocalyptic about that. Because, of course, the last day of the world is a little disingenuous. Collapse, you know, doesn't necessarily happen like that, as a falling off a cliff. Collapse happens, like we see, with an increasing severity of extreme weather, fires and floods and freezing, which then makes for an increasing strain on food supply, an increasing strain on the resources of fresh water and electricity and communication networks. And, you know, much of the world that probably you and I live in, here we are on an internet connection, you know, looking into screens, many of us aren't well prepared for a world without infrastructure. We're not well prepared for a world without well-stocked shops. We're not well prepared for a world without transport links. Not well prepared for collapsing conditions. You know that line. There's two lines in Redemption Song, by Bob Marley. And the first line is, you know, it gets a lot of attention from meditators. It's like, yeah, yeah. So emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. That sounds like a pretty good endorsement of meditation practice. But then the next line is the one that's actually, which is deeper, and which I've always found, you know, equally or more inspiring. Have no fear for atomic energy, because none of them can stop the time. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Have no fear for atomic energy, because none of them can stop the time. It's written, what, 79, 80, maybe? I think Bob Marley had already been diagnosed with cancer at that stage. So his world was collapsing. He's also writing that in the height of the Cold War, the nuclear standoff between the USA and Russia, each with thousands and thousands and thousands of nuclear bombs, enough to destroy. Some of you are old enough to, like me, to have grown up in that time, right? We knew there's enough nuclear bombs to destroy all life on Earth many, many times over. And the idea of the 4-minute warning, and that these, you know, maniacs in the White House and the Kremlin get the push of a button could wipe out life on Earth. I don't understand the insanity of that, the destructiveness of that, the hatred, and driving all that along. But just that reflection, cutting through that, in times when one might reflect on collapse, have no fear for atomic energy. One could replace atomic energy by all kinds of other, symptoms or agents of destruction. For none of them can stop the time. In that sense, that life itself isn't in danger. That doesn't mean we sit back and do nothing about atomic energy in the song, or about deforestation, or about resource consumption. Right? No, one might feel actually given the miracle of life, given our belonging to everyone, one might well feel not just inspired to, but compelled, like people are doing, like good friends are doing, like people you know probably maybe in London are doing with Extinction Rebellion this week. A dear friend of mine posted a very evocative image of himself sitting against a railing with one of those D-locks around his neck, and just sitting up straight in meditation, and then locked onto a railing, this D-lock, just sitting there, just bearing witness to the destructive forces of culture, sitting there on behalf of all beings. And yet that sense, life itself isn't in any danger. We tend to have a small view. We think of most essentially of me and my loss of comfort, security, life. And then me and my dear ones. And then, maybe we think in terms of all beings and other species and the trees. And, we think in terms of all of those terms. And yet, collectively, however much we might evoke our responsibility to ourselves and each other and all species and all of life on Earth, we also might notice how easily, how, even though it might have a painful impact to sensitive beings like you and me, that somehow when something's far off, how easily the mind makes it irrelevant. We put it out of sight, out of mind. And so there's a flickering moment of distress about because of friends suffering in New York with the floods, of people losing electricity in Louisiana, of all the various different tragedies, the plight of women in Afghanistan, the plight of women in Texas, the all of that which we could point to, and yet in the way it somehow has a kind of unreality to it when it's not me. And even though that might not be true sometimes in some moments for you or me particularly, it's true enough in the collective that we see there's this collective inertia to really turn things around. We're somehow quite helpless in the face of collapse. Just like we tend to go along knowing full well that this body is collapsing. And yet somehow the way we push death out of the picture so much, as if somehow, philosophically it doesn't set and make sense, but as if somehow it won't happen to me. That's why Buddhist practices, you can see the skulls here and here and here on my wrist, you know. That's why Buddhist practice encourages us to reflect in terms of death reflection, to realize this is collapsing. So that somewhat counterintuitively, the more we live in the light of our own impending death, the more genuinely empowered we are, the more fearless we are, the more capable we are, the more open we are to living well, to belonging to all of this life in its fragility, in its preciousness, in its wonder, in its immediacy, in its here right nowness. And that's exactly the same, it seems to me, collectively. The more wide awake the more we understand the potential for collapse, the possibility of collapse, the actuality of that which is collapsing, the more emotionally equipped we are, the more wide awake we are, the more fearless we are to do whatever seems like one's own response. And that can't be mandated, right? What is your response? What should be your response? What could be your response? I don't know. For some, it's being chained to railings like that in London. To others, it's the explorations around deep adaptation. To others, it's planting trees today and tomorrow until the last day of the world. To others, it's being of service to other humans or to other species, to those in health and to those in struggle and to those in collapse. So, of course, I have no conclusions in this exploration. I mostly wanted to, because, you know, the latest IPCC report, very grim reading, just came out in August. And because this is in the air. And also because it's summer for many of us and it's sort of holiday time. And because it easily goes out of the air, I wanted to use this first meeting of the year to, you know, to bring the conversation alive. And so having got this far, I'll end my reflections and open the conversation to you. So friends, please feel free to come forth with concerns or questions or confusions or clarities. You know, maybe you have strong ideas about this. Maybe you quite strongly disagree with some of the points I've made. Maybe there's just, you know, there's just something in the heart around all this that could do with giving a little air too. So any and all of that is welcome. You can use that little ask a question button down the bottom. I see some people have already filled it out. And just before we get into all of that, let me say something just about Sangha Live in general. You know, the platform is here for you. It's freely offered. There are classes every Sunday. There are the live this is live too, but there are the morning meditations at 8 o'clock in three different time zones, Europe, East Coast, US, West Coast, Monday to Friday. And I'll be here for the next 3 weeks of that. And it's all runs on this basis of dana, this sense of, our sense of belonging really to each other. It's a sense of giving to each other, supporting each other, appreciating each other. So, hey, we want to support you the best we can. And we ask you to support us the best you can. And there's no other form of support for Sangha life, right? It's your dana. It's people showing up here and caring about what's happening, wanting to support the platform being here. It's, you know, if you appreciate the way this is a support in your life, then you're, you know, allowing that to keep happening. But you're also very directly allowing others to benefit from whatever's offered here. So thank you in advance. Thank you for supporting Sangha Live, the platform. Thank you because it also supports me and the other teachers that are here. So that green button there is how you can offer dana. And it's, yeah, it's very directly what keeps the light on at Sangha Live and supports me too. So thank you for that. All right. Helen says, what about personal collapse during these trying times? Yeah. Yeah. What about personal collapse? You know, when we say personal collapse, Helen, you know, we're usually referring, I mean, there's the physical collapse, right? We're all dying, you know, on a time scale that's not of our choosing. Right, we're all dying, and we're heading for that in on a time scale and in a situation that we don't know. Right, so there's that kind of collapse, and then there's what's often called, you know, the collapse, mental emotional collapse, and just the term climate grief, climate anxiety. Right, these are terms that have been coined to point to the condition where people are collapsing mentally and emotionally under the fear and uncertainty, right? Grief, helplessness, anger, you know, rage. All of those are very understandable emotions. They're also powerful and painful emotions. And they're emotions that might certainly lead to mental and emotional collapse. So in a way, it's like taking good care of ourselves mentally, emotionally, learning how to be skillful with anger, learning how our fear locks onto all kinds of displaced objects, you know, displacement fears, learning how to meet and dissolve and make room for fear, learning how to let it all belong, learning to be unafraid of our own minds and genuinely caring of our own hearts. That's the best possible support for being able to collapse well. That's Joanna's term, Joanna Macy's term, collapsing well. And she's talking about that. And, you know, what does it mean to collapse well? If indeed we're the last generation, you know, to use that phrase again, how might we collapse well? And so that's true collectively, but it's also true personally. You know, how might you collapse well? A lot of people go along with denial of their own death, fear of their own death, and a fear of even of addressing it or turning towards it. So I would say Dharma practices very directly in all kinds of different ways, and I'll address some of those over the next few weeks in the weekday classes. It's ways of learning to collapse well, ways of going, you know, bowing towards our impending death with lightness and humor and love. Right? That doesn't mean we're in any hurry to get there. No, we want to cherish life, to cherish being here. There's a kind of natural, sounds like a contradiction, but the natural harmony, actually, between, on the one hand, cherishing the fact that we're here and wanting to support life, the life that's here, the life that's here. And at the same time, in parallel with that, the willingness to collapse graciously, you know. Yeah. Alison says, could you let us know if you'll be teaching or leading retreats in the UK at all this year? I won't, Alison. I will do an online retreat at some point. I think maybe the last week of November, in English. Yeah, I'm not traveling so much at the moment, partly because of the way the world is, partly because of my own health since COVID, although that is getting better. Partly because I just started to wonder, I said to Gail a few weeks ago, maybe I won't travel to teach retreats anymore. Maybe I'll only teach at the Mulan. That's not a position yet, but It won't be this year. I will. Let's see if I and the world hold together and things. Probably next year. Yeah. But I'll do an online retreat in English at the end of November. And there's a whole bunch of online stuff, like courses and things within the infrastructure of Sangha Live as well. Pubali says, is it possible that everything that's happening is part of the patterns of the universe, a way for our planet to collapse so it can rest and rejuvenate like it did during the Ice Age? So the collapse may only be temporary before there's a rebirth. Yes, it's certainly possible, Pubali. Who knows? I wouldn't know what to say. But I would say, when I talk about collapse and I say about, you know, the last day of the world and the last generation, those are sort of evocative or poetic ways of speaking, right, in a way. It's not really, whatever kind of mess we make of the pollutions of forests and oceans, what might seem to us from a very human-centric point of view to be the end of the world, of course, isn't the end of the world. There will be an end of the world, but it's in millions and millions of years. The sun's going to burn for a long time. So, and in the life scale of the planet, what looks to us like the end of the world, right? A few hundred thousand years, maybe, of the loss of even all complex life, even if it got that bad. That's just, you know, for the planet, that's the equivalent in our life scale of, you know, being in bed with the flu for a couple of weeks. So yes, the planet. I remember in India when I was living with my teacher near to Dharamsala, and this was in the early 90s, and it was the very advent of plastic in India. And when I first arrived, there was no bottled water. Just didn't exist. Plastic packaging barely existed. Most things were sold wrapped in leaves. And the leaves were discarded and the cows would eat the leaves, and it kind of, you know, just worked like that. And then with the advent of plastic, people would discard it in the same way. There wasn't any infrastructure for collecting garbage. And through the 90s, India got very, very, very filled up with trash. You know, people were just throwing plastic garbage everywhere. And some of the Tibetan refugees in Dharamsala, in conjunction with some of the long-term Westerners staying there, set up a garbage collection and disposal project. And it was a great project. They cleaned up the valley. It was really a great project. But my Indian teacher, who I was living with, was confused by the fact that they were caught. They kept calling it saving the planet. And the sort of logo, and we've got to save the planet. And Babaji was, what's all this about saving the planet? And he just would point out to the fact that the planet isn't in any danger. It's an incredibly kind of human, arrogant view, in a way, the idea that we need to save the planet. No, we need to save, you know, ourselves and our neighbors. That's what's in danger, right? Ourselves and many, many other species, you know. But I think that's helpful to realize the planet isn't in danger. Life, that's what Bob Marley's line means, right? Have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop the time. Did some of you see that image I put on Instagram, or was it Facebook, a couple of weeks ago? That, like, vast, vast sense of, like, way beyond, a vast image from outer space with our galaxy containing 100 million stars as a pinprick in the galaxy. That sense of, life is vast and infinite. Life is in no danger whatsoever. Oh, it's very heart relieving, you know, relieving of the kind of the terrible responsibility we might feel, the too much sense of responsibility we might feel. Yes. Sandy says, how can we reduce identifying and clinging so much to comfort so that living with fewer destructive pleasures is not so threatening? That's a really good question, Sandy. You know, I think that's the question. That's a question for each of us. You know, how-to questions are a little tricky, right? So, and I think there's a danger, actually, in putting too much emphasis. So you, Sandy and you and me and others here might feel, it just, it's part of that same spirit of planting a tree on the last day of the world, to live in a way that's simple, to live in a way that's reflective, to live in a way where we're conscious of around our consumption, to live in a way where our pleasures aren't hungry ghost pleasures, you know, aren't rapacious pleasures. And at the same time, I think there's a danger in putting too much emphasis on what you and me can do, because while our individual actions are deeply important in terms of living a coherent life, living in line with our values, any sense of really changing around destructive and consumptive culture has to be, you know, radical. That's why Extinction Rebellion are targeting, you know, banks and fossil fuel companies and governments, you know, because unless governments mandate radically different ways of doing things, you know, then the emphasis on the way you and me should recycle and should reduce our consumption, etc., can increase that sense of kind of unbearable pressure. So any sense of changing our lifestyle, beautiful and important, but let it go along with a sense of doing that so as to live a life of love and alignment and goodness and that sense of living one's values, rather than the sense of trying, of doing it as some sense of holding the responsibility as if I've got to, you know, save the planet, as it were. All right. I see that someone has appeared on screen. Yes, Rafaela.
Hi. Nice to see you. Yeah, thank you. I'm really appreciating this. I'm feeling less alone just hearing your reflections. Something that occurred to me in the meditation is how I'm feeling a lot of tenderness, especially around my children, for my children, or like being a parent in this time. And when I'm in a place of fear and not giving much room to this, I'm also constricted, and I'm also choosing to sever my oneness with the larger support system of which I could be supported. So mm-hmm. there's definitely mm-hmm. something really valuable in allowing, which also then means I'm allowing myself to stay open and supported by, so that there's something about staying open in pain, yeah. in painful
yeah. yeah.
experiences. Yes.
The habitual response to pain is, ouch, I don't want it, and I want to shut down to it. And yet, like you say, there's something about staying open to pain. That's where we get really resourced. No. And we learned early on, before we had the capacity, right, to really understand how to stay open, we learned to be protective, to be small, to shut down around pain. And so that recognition that you're pointing to, and I just again and again, again and again, you'll see yourself, of course you will, you'll see the movement to shutting down again and again. And there's just to see if you can let that be like the needle of the compass of your heart, right? That remembering of this something, even when it feels counterintuitive, there's something about opening in the midst of pain that's just makes deep sense.
There's also something I noticed that I'm finding that really challenging, and I live in a city and I'm really like in the midst of a lot of impressions of what I perceive to be people in fragile and tender states.
Yeah.
And the way that that can play out if it's not met with love. And so I'm also witnessing that. And that's also making me sort of fearful and somehow protect. But then, yeah, that cuts me off again. So,
yeah.
It's challenging to keep.
It's challenging. Open. It's challenging to, you know, it's hard to keep your heart open. Mm-hmm. Right. It's hard to keep your heart open. Mm. And yet what you've also been seeing is it's even harder to try and meet the world with it closed down.
Thank you.
It's hard. I found that really helpful. Oh, it's hard to keep my heart open, but it's much harder to go around like that. And then I've got to, all the work that that takes to fend everything off. And so, you know, that's why we call it practice, right? The practice is the interplay between what I know about staying open and the habits of closing down. And so then the way we make that practice happen is that we use all the triggers, the people you see, the states they're in, the fear for your children, all that stuff. We'll use that as a way of tracking the tendency to shut down and as a way of reminding us of the possibility of opening up.
Yeah, it creates more issues, that closing down, as well, because it creates othering and seeing other people and creating mind stuff about others,
right?
And good, bad, right, wrong, and
because it doesn't actually work, right? It's not like you actually shut down and all those difficulties and all those people and everything just disappear. Mm. They're still there, but now you've got to deal with the that and you've got to deal with this. Mm. All right. Thank
you. Love.
Thanks for coming on and speaking as well.
Thank you.
How are we doing? Oh, we still got some time. All right. Let's see. Kathleen says the whole subject in regards to vaccination, if people, whoops, that question just vanished off my screen, and given it was about this unbelievably polarized subject of vaccination, maybe that's just as well. It might, let's see if it comes back. Lauren says, my most immediate fears are not for my own death, but for the suffering I and we may experience while alive. I manage these fears by considering that I've managed to survive and thrive through many losses and traumas, thanks in large part to Dharma practice. But the sense that much of this could have been avoided brings anger and huge grief. Yeah. So, of course, I understand that, Lauren. It makes sense to me. But if you'll let me just be blunt for a moment, that's useless thought. That's a delusion. The idea that this could have been avoided is a useless delusion. Right, it's like saying I could have won the lottery if I'd known the numbers in advance. You know, there's an infinite amount of could haves, but they're completely unreal because you can't go back and redo the past. Right, so be really careful about the loops of, oh, if only we'd have, or why couldn't we have, or what's the matter that we didn't? It's like you can roam around just torturing yourself in the world of how we could have done it differently. Clearly, we couldn't. Clearly, we just couldn't do it differently. Right? This is the way we've done it. And so I would imagine that roaming around, the being seduced into the could have, is some kind of displacement for anger and grief. And I wonder then, what else? How might you, if you don't go so much to the what you're angry and sad about, what we could have done differently, and you just let yourself tend to the anger and grief. Anger and grief, you're tending to your anger and grief is really, really helpful and important. It's much more important than all the things you could imagine about how we could have done things differently. Yeah. And my experience tending to anger and grief helps us to feel fearless, you know, about that which we can tend with, to that which we can meet. And that addresses the other part of your question then. You know. So we say, oh, I'm not afraid of death. I'm afraid of the pain. That is fear of death. it's the same fear, right? A sense of being bracing for something that I don't want to happen. Of course you don't want to happen. Of course, none of us, we don't want to live through discomfort. We don't want to live through difficulty. We don't want to live through disaster. And our anticipation of what it's going to be, would be like, or could be like to live through difficulty and disaster tends, just like the distortions of going back to what could have been, the distortions of going forward to what might be similarly distorted. You know, when I was a kid, I used to look out through the window. I hated the rain. I'd look out through the window and I'd see people in the outside in the rain. And I think, ooh, you're horrible. Ooh, outside the rain, you're running down your neck. And ooh, and I'd be, oh, thank God I'm inside. Oh, I'd hate to be out in the rain. And then sometimes I'd be out and it rains. And it's like, oh, it's not so bad. Right. Now I know there's lots worse things that you might be imagining than rain. But that small example, it really showed me how my anticipation of discomfort was completely disproportional to my capacity to actually be with discomfort. And so you might attend to that just with the small things, the small things. Oh, I hope I'm not late. Oh, I hope that doesn't happen. And then that thing we didn't want to happen, when it happens, you can just deal with it, you know. Oh, what if I missed my train? And then maybe you do miss your train and you just deal with it, you know. So be aware of the backwards projections into what could have been and the way that becomes a vortex for your anger and grief, and the forward projections into what could be and the way that becomes a vortex for fear and anxiety. All right. Nick says, is there a way through Sangha Life for us to connect with others here who live near to us? Yes. So through the daily practices Monday to Friday, Nick, people have connected that way, and have WhatsApp groups and get together with others. So if you come back during the week, you can see how some of that works. And if you want to just add into the chat box where you live, then, you know, you can see right now, maybe, although we're only here for another couple of minutes, if others live near you. All right, friends. So it's 9:30. It's, you know, this can, like I said at the beginning, this can feel all a bit heavy duty and intense, this material. But when we touch into it, we also see how we're touching into interconnection and compassion, right? Belonging and love. How to meet the stuff of our lives in a way that feels just sane and real. A way that the heart can still thrive and connect and make good sense of our lives, even while things are falling apart. So I hope this has been fruitful and useful. That's the intention. You know, and I want to just thank you for being here, for lending your ears, lending your heart, participating. And please come back. I'll be here all week, as they say. So, and this theme of belonging, I was just, and a sense of infinite belonging. I think certainly all this week and maybe next week, we'll see how long it lasts. But that theme of belonging in all kinds of different ways will be a little bit the thread that runs through the next few weeks of morning meetings. And last thing I'll say is, if you're in New York, I'm going to be there in November for my book launch, and Tricycle and New York Insight are co-hosting a launch event in Tribeca, New York City, on the 6th of November. And if you're, certainly if I know you in New York, but even if we haven't met yet, if you'd like, and if you're in New York and you'd like to come to the book launch, you're welcome. I'd love to see you and love to meet you there. And if you send your address to contact@martinaylward.com, maybe Melanie, you can just type that in. If you send your email address to contact@martinaylward.com and say that you'd like to come to the book launch on November 6th in New York, then you'll get an email, someone saying, where is Tribeca? It's in the southern tip of Manhattan. It's in New York City. Yeah. All right, friends, here's honoring and celebrating the belonging in which we find ourselves here right now. And maybe just this last minute or so, we might just consciously extend out that sense of belonging so that we take in each other here and our loved ones and our neighbours and our neighbours' neighbours. And those, you know, all those that we share this world with, those we love and those we find difficult, those that are near and those that are far, those that cover the earth, those that share our human nature, and those that have their own nature, animal nature, bird nature, fish nature, tree nature. There's a way in which we all have life nature. There's a way in which we completely belong to life. And so may our living and dying, may our feeling and expressing and acting and responding, may it all express that belonging. And may our practices help us deepen into trusting that deep belonging. We belong to life. Life is in no danger. Nothing can go wrong. And may the heart know that deeply. There's a way to navigate through all the stuff that looks like it's going wrong, you know, day by day. All right, friends, love to you all. Hope to see you, some of you, bright and early tomorrow morning for the beginnings of our daily meditations. Thank you, Melanie, for hosting. Thank you all for the support you offer to me and to Sangha Live. Over and out. See you soon.